You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. Setting the Record Straight, today about Bloody Mary and Bloodier Betty, two queens of England. So we're talking today about two half-sisters. One was a Catholic, Queen Mary, Queen of Scots, who is remembered with a shaded reputation as Bloody Mary, who executed those Protestant martyrs, hundreds of them. And then there's Queen Elizabeth I, who in the popular media is one of the most praised, if not the most praised, ruler in history, certainly the most praised woman ruler in history. She ruled England during the so-called Golden Age, 1558-1603. Now, scholars use that term Golden Age. You know it, everyone knows it, as Elizabethan Age, named after her. She was beloved and deified in her own time, and after her death was known as Gloriana Austriae, the goddess of justice, the Virgin Queen, and Good Queen Bess, among other laudatory titles. She was the daughter of King Henry VIII. Uh-oh, sarcasm alert, and we all know what a remarkably virtuous man King Henry VIII was. And her mother was Anne Boleyn. Enough said. Elizabeth was educated by the foremost humanists of the age. Did I say humanists? We'll talk about humanists in another program. She spoke a number of languages and was well-read in classical literature. She was a scholar and a poet, and served as an inspiration for the scholars and poets of her golden age, better known as her Elizabethan age. Queen Elizabeth refuted the common belief at the time that women made ineffective rulers. I don't know how common that belief was. After all, the world had just witnessed a generation prior to this, the great Queen Isabella, Queen of Castile, sponsor of the discovery of the New World, and a master administrator of her kingdom in what became Spain. But we'll leave that for another program. But let us be fair to Queen Elizabeth, and let us be objective. She may have been a savage persecutor of Roman Catholics, but Elizabeth did preside over an age of relative stability at the twilight of the Tudor dynasty. Now, you'll have to pardon me if for emphasis, I have a little fun with sarcasm, because this is one of the most praised women in history. And isn't her reputation of such elephantine and overblown proportions that it deserves a little parody? It deserves a Monty Python sketch, actually. You have to laugh. What else can you do? Well, what I do is I've got a good friend who calls her Bloodier Betty. When I heard that, I really laughed, and I'm stealing it. Here on Setting the Record Straight, we try to take some of the crooked accounts of history and straighten them out, give you the straight dope. We make the crooked straight. But when talking about the glorious Gloriana Queen Elizabeth, there's a lot to straighten out. A twisted Gordon knot of crookedness, because so many people, most people have such a media-induced high esteem for Elizabeth, which she partly deserves, and in very serious ways that have to do with morality, she does not at all. She was a ruthless persecutor of Catholics and of those that she thought were her enemies. She ignited what became one of the largest and most extensive religiosides against Catholics in history. The first would have to be Diocletian in Rome and a few other Roman emperors. The second would be Elizabeth and what she ignited, and followed by Thomas Cromwell. And the third happened in the 20th century, the combination of the Spanish Civil War and the Cristeros War in Mexico. It was severe persecution under Elizabeth, where being a Catholic would get you tortured to death, not burned at the stake, which would have been merciful. The techniques of execution of the Spanish Inquisition. No, in England, the death was made to be public, prolonged after extensive torture, drawing and quartering the bowels, the intestines drawn out very slowly. Then the person quartered, the four limbs tied to four horses that were sent off in different directions. But of course, at first you were hung until you were almost dead. But they wanted your life preserved so that the public could witness vicariously your tremendous pain. And Elizabeth ordered new methods of torture be prolonged so that the pain could be prolonged and more evident as a warning to anyone who opposed her ruthless religious intolerance. But in the popular mind of our time, she's a queen who little girls would love to imagine themselves being. There's so many films about her. Yeah, let's talk about that. Her filmography is huge. 2007, The Golden Age. Cate Blanchett returns to her Oscar-winning part as Queen Elizabeth. Then 2005, Elizabeth I, a TV drama. Then 2005, The Virgin Queen. Then Elizabeth Rex, TV play, 2003. Gloriana, 2000, TV drama. Then Elizabeth, 2000, TV documentary. Then The Royal Diaries of Elizabeth I. The Royal Rose of the House of Tudor, 30-minute video to be shown in schools. The biography series on TV, 1999, Elizabeth I. Then there's Elizabeth, 1998. That was the first one. Focusing on the early years of Elizabeth's reign, starring one of my favorite actresses, Cate Blanchett, again. Then there was Gloriana, TV opera in 1984. I could go on. Elizabeth R. Glenda Jackson, great actress as Elizabeth. Going back in time, even Judith Anderson played Queen Elizabeth in 1968. Betty Davis in The Virgin Queen from 1955. Gene Simmons as the young Bess in 1953 in a movie. The Seahawk, a great score for this film, I have it. It's a lush recording that will really test your speakers. Huge orchestra, great stuff. The Seahawk is a 1940 film starring Errol Flynn. Then The Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex, 1939, that's another Betty Davis film. Then Fire Over England, 37. The Virgin Queen, 1923. It was a documentary. Of course, there's even a French film. Les Amours de la Reine Elisabeth. The Loves of Queen Elizabeth, starring, believe it or not, Sarah Bernhardt. At this point, I'm starting to feel like Rapunzel. Or even worse, maybe Sisyphus. Oh, you and I have a big job. Discourages me a bit. Look at this mountain of disinformation to dig through to find the real Elizabethan era and to find the real Elizabeth. But if nobody else will, let's you and I do it. Let's attempt to find the real Elizabeth and what really happened. It's quite a different story. The romantic part has some truth in it, too. Hey, I left something out. I shouldn't leave out the wonderful film, Shakespeare in Love of 98. Judi Dench appears as an older Queen Elizabeth, a wonderful actress. I could go on. And I will say for poor Queen Mary that she was portrayed by Katharine Hepburn in a 1936 film. Written by Maxwell Anderson, no less. I haven't seen it, but it's called Mary of Scotland. And I'm able to find reference to a few more obscure films that tell Mary's side of the story, like The Twisted Tale of Bloody Mary, a 2008 film. Made in Britain. And in the summary for the film, it says, "History has called her Bloody Mary for the burning of Protestants. But how fair is this? This film paints another picture of a woman true to her beliefs, pushed toward a terrible psychological disintegration. Because Mary had become an outcast after Henry divorced her mother, and she was a threat to the Protestant succession." So let's you and I dig a little deeper now. Let's examine the life of Queen Elizabeth in the times, and start with Queen Mary, her predecessor. Let's base it on responsible sources, authoritative sources, which I can assure you have no anti-Catholic bias. And I'll put out on the table and declare my own pro-Catholic sentiments. And I'll keep them there where I can keep an eye on them and keep them in check. So let's talk about Queen Mary, Bloody Mary. Well, after Henry VIII died, and it's an established fact that he died thinking of himself as a Catholic, his son, Edward VI, took over the throne. Well, this little boy was only 9. He was a boy king. And Thomas Cranmer, quite a schemer, had at last someone to whom he could speak as a near equal. Edward was to be the savior of the Protestant cause that had been fading from lack of royal support. So with this little boy came another outburst of smashed altars, abolished saints, whitewashed walls, smashed statuaries, painting over a religious mural, prescribed rites, forbidden celebrations, denial of marriage as a sacrament. Because, sarcasm alert, because divorce is the sacrament of the English and Episcopal churches that Henry VIII created and Elizabeth created by two acts of Parliament. Other novel and new introductions of the English church were married priests, Of course, it's led to gay priests in our day and bishops, and a purely symbolic communion of bread and wine. My dear British friends observed to me with a twinkle in their eyes that this bread is no different than what you can buy down at the bakery. Now, when I told an American friend of mine what they had said, he said this: "Did you know where the Protestants appear in the Bible? They're in the New Testament." I said, "No, I've never seen that." He said, "Here it is." Flipped it open and read this: John 6:66. "From this time many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him."
And my friend said, "Chuck, look at what precedes it." He put his finger on the page and I read, "I am the living bread, which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh." The Jews then disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" So Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you." Most of those disciples and followers who were there with him in Capernaum could not accept what he said, could not accept that what Jesus said was a fact, could not accept the transubstantiation of bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. They couldn't accept that. And most of them left and went away. And my friend said, "Do you see? Schism. The first schism." Ah, yes. The first Protestants. Yes. On this realization, we just have to take a break. This is Breadbox Media, Chuck Coughlin.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. On Setting the Record Straight today, we're considering two English queens, Bloody Mary the Catholic and Bloodier Betty the Anti-Catholic. This is the real story behind the two queens. You know, there's something my son had to say on the last program, and I'm sorry he's not with us today. He will be. We're going to do a program very soon on astrophysics, and my 10-year-old has quite a few observations about that, relative to quantum physics and Catholicism.
I want to recommend a book on that subject by Robert J. Spitzer, a Jesuit. It's called New Proofs for the Existence of God. Spitzer examines the considerable evidence for God in creation that has come to light from physics and philosophy during the last 40 years. Take a look at it.
A few minutes ago, I'd mentioned that when they formed the Church of England, one of the tenets was the denial of the transubstantiation of the Eucharist. And we came across something rather interesting. Just before the last break, we were talking about the great discovery in Scripture made by my friend in Harrodsburg. There's Protestants in the Bible, in the New Testament, in John 6. We were talking a bit about it before the break, and my friend said, "Let's go to the verses that precede the one we talked about." Go to same chapter, verse 61. Jesus said, "I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world." Then the Jews began to argue sharply among themselves, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" Jesus said to them, "Very truly I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you will have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise them up upon the last day. For my flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me, and I in them, just as the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father. So the one who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread that came down from heaven. Your ancestors ate manna and died, but whoever feeds on this bread will live forever. He said this while teaching in the synagogue in Capernaum. On hearing it, many of his disciples said, and here my friends stopped reading and looked at me and said, note this. Here it is. Many of his disciples didn't believe him. Here's the Protestants. Then my friend looked back at his Bible and continued reading. This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it? Aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, Jesus said to them, does this offend you? Then what if you see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before? The Spirit gives life. The flesh counts for nothing. The words I have spoken to you, they are full of the Spirit and life. Yet there are some of you who do not believe. For Jesus had known from the beginning which of them did not believe and who would betray him. He went on to say, this is why I told you that no one can come to me unless the Father has enabled them. And then the last sentence. From this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. They couldn't accept that the bread was flesh and that the wine was blood. My friend said, see, first Protestants. I got it. So we see where the English government and crown, which are the same thing now, it's a pure theocracy, went awry, got crooked, and the knot was tied and became complicated and difficult to straighten out, to set the record straight. Here's the next part. Remember little Edward, the boy king, Henry VIII's son? Little Edward, at the age of 10, proclaimed the Pope the true son of the devil, an antichrist, and an abominable tyrant. Well, he knew how to speak Thomas Cranmer's language, but the boy died in his 16th year. But not before he and Cranmer, among others, had conspired to keep Henry VIII's daughter by Catherine of Aragon, the Catholic and rightful heir, Mary Tudor. This is the queen we call Bloody Mary. To keep Mary Tudor, the rightful heir, from the throne. It was a misbegotten conspiracy that made Lady Jane Grey queen for a fortnight, and dead soon thereafter when she became the focal point of a revolt. Cranmer was arrested. He tried to prevent his execution by recanting his heirs. When that didn't save him, he recanted the recantation. That didn't save him either. Therein lies the problem. Mary Tudor could have gone into history books as Queen Mary, restorer of the faith. And with that, England might have remained a Catholic country, because the people in their hearts were still Catholic, other than the bought-off rulers. And who knows what was really in their hearts, other than the bought-off noblemen who had been distributed the property. One-fifth of England's land area was given to them. It would have been the property of the Catholic Church, who had reclaimed some of it from marshes and swamplands 1,100 years before, and with the labor of centuries, had created little communities surrounded by an agrarian class of prosperous land tenants. Of course, that was destroyed under Henry VIII, and those people were impoverished. The correct view of the monasteries is they existed for the peasant, for the poor. They were the patrimony of the poor, the inheritance of the poor. It went on for 1,100 years. And the poor lost most of everything when the nobles took over. And the poverty so familiar from Charles Dickens' later accounts of it was graded at that moment. Well, unfortunately, we do know Mary as Bloody Mary, because in the battle between Catholics and Protestants over who could claim the most martyrs, Mary was an avid scorer of her own goals. When Queen Mary Tudor entered London in triumph in 1553, it was with the support of the people, the nobility, and the arms bearers of the kingdoms. On St. Andrew's Day, England was officially, by royal decree, reunited in submission to the Roman Catholic Church. The old religion was restored. The people's holidays, traditional forms of worship, and religious arts was returned. Sensibly, Mary did not try to reclaim the monasteries for the church, but let the expropriation of all that property stand as a sop to the materialistic nobility, to maintain the peace of the realm, and to buy their allegiance, because their allegiance had been easily bought before away from the Catholic Church by Henry VIII. This does not say much for the character of the majority of English nobility. Well, opposing the Protestant rulers could get you beheaded or imprisoned in the Tower of London, or worse. So let's not be too hard on them. Returning to England to advise Mary on reconstructing the church was Cardinal Reginald Pole, who became an Archbishop of Canterbury. Well, Pole had his own claim to a throne. He was the son of Edward IV's niece, and during the reign of Edward VI had failed by a single vote to become Pope. Previously, he had stood up to Henry VIII in behalf of Mary's mother and the church. Was renowned for its good character, it was regarded as a liberal Catholic, eager to find a common ground and to reconcile Lutherans with the church. He was by nature a peace-loving man, a studious man, but sadly he seems to have had little influence on Mary's domestic politics. Her first misstep was her choice of husband, Philip of Spain. It was not that objectively Philip was a bad choice. In many ways, he was a perfect choice, linking England again to the Habsburgs, the most powerful family in Europe. And he did prove a wise counselor to the Queen. What made him problematic was xenophobia, which at this time was the most popular legacy of the English Reformation. Well, because it's popular, we'll go to that great mass of information and disinformation known as Wikipedia. It defines xenophobia as the unreasoned fear of that which is perceived to be foreign or strange. Basically, someone that's biased against foreigners. Well, the English people at that time had a bad case of xenophobia. And they didn't like Philip of Spain, because he was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon. And now that Mary had brought another Spaniard to the English court, Protestants began to suspect that England was being delivered to a foreign monarchy, as well as to a foreign pope. Actually, they didn't have that much to fear from Philip. He was tolerant. He would not force Englishmen to give up bear baiting in favor of bullfights. He would not import the Spanish Inquisition. He was not going to compel Morris dancers to import castanets and dance the flamenco. He was, in fact, very well aware of the mood of people. He quite liked his new subjects. Let's say that he had a strong bias toward the English. No, oddly, it was his wife, the queen, who misjudged her people, her mind perhaps already clouded by the cancer that was presumed to have killed her. It was she who was not content with reclaiming the throne and restoring the church. She felt compelled to seek vengeance on those who had betrayed her mother, denied the church, and remained a threat, in her own mind at least, to her security. And so, for a period of 3 years, against the advice of her husband Philip and other Catholics close to the throne, Mary ordered and executed nearly 300 people. It was Mary who delivered to the Protestants of England their greatest propaganda weapon, a book, John Fox's Book of Martyrs, which I discussed two programs ago. A book which my biblically literate Protestant friends still carry around as a second volume, as exhibit number one of the treacherous immorality of Catholics. So it's been one of the greatest propaganda weapons against the Catholic Church in history, because this book commemorated the burnings at the stake that Mary ordered, and was forever linked in the English mind with the Roman Catholic Church and persecution. So when Mary died in 1558, the Catholic cause in England was effectively ended. Who was the new queen? It was Gloriana, Elizabeth I, and this was the beginning of the flowering of the Elizabethan age. And all that meant good and bad. With that, we must break now. I'll see you on the other side. This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
This is Setting the Record Straight. Back again, Chuck Coughlin. We were talking about Queen Elizabeth I, the anti-Catholic queen called Gloriana. Gloriana, the daughter of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. And she issued a document with the ominous title of the Act of Uniformity. There was a great deal of intolerance in this document. With the queen reserving herself all the powers her father had wrested from the church. So now we had, in effect, a female false pope. Even if Pope Joan is not real, Queen Elizabeth is. If she tilted the theology in a Protestant direction, it was because she saw, as had Cromwell, Catholics were beholden to a foreign pope backed by foreign princes. She never tilted it too far because Elizabeth was no more of a Protestant than she was a Catholic. Matter of fact, she kept crucifixed on her desk. She had no sympathy with the Puritans, whose yearning for a democratic dictatorship on the Calvinist model would have threatened her crown, and on whose public strictures would have denied Merry England its merriness, and the English Renaissance the work of its playwrights, like Shakespeare. Oh, Shakespeare, I've been looking into this. Nobody is sure he was a secret Catholic, but there were a lot of secret Catholics at the time. But the theory that he was Catholic, when you look at the evidence, is a very, very, very probable theory. No doubt. Look into it. Joseph Pierce has a good book on the subject. She did sponsor the works of William Shakespeare. She was simply a patriot who wanted a patriotic national religion and cared not a fig for theological dispute. This practical Machiavellian approach worked. She won. Elizabeth's huge advance over her father is that she made the Anglican Church popular. She led them by their hearts. She did so by displacing the cult of the Virgin Mary with the cult of the Virgin Queen, who was too devoted to her people to marry. Royal processions replaced religious ones. You can see it today in England. She became the embodiment of England. The English love their pomp and circumstance, don't they? Her accession day became an immediate national holiday. She was the deliverer of battlefield victories and the inaugurator of an English renaissance of literary and worldly discovery, punctuated in good Tudor style by a chopping block for handsome members of the opposite sex, like the Earl of Essex, a reputed lover, who eventually offended the crown, lost his head. If the queen and her successor, James I, who executed Sir Walter Raleigh for mocking his Scotch antecedents, held the power to excommunicate her handsomest and wittiest subjects, it was because she commanded a total state. In England, we have a totalitarian state. She had extremely powerful advisors, like William Cecil, Lord Burghley. But her bejeweled hand alone held the power of praise or condemnation, and she pursued the practical, the Machiavellian course. She governed as an English church whose trinity of God, Queen, and country gave British sea dogs like Sir Francis Drake and Sir John Hawkins, the latter of whom took the advantage of King Philip II's moral qualms to elbow aside Spaniards and take over the Atlantic slave trade. So she erected a banner of religious patriotism by the act of raiding the Spanish Main, where once Vikings had raided monasteries out of sheer acquisitiveness. Now their English inheritors seized booty from Catholic Spain in her possessions, secure in the Protestant doctrine that they were justified by faith and their salvation could not be lost, and were liberating gold from the allies of the Whore of Babylon, the Catholic Church. Of course, it was also an awful lot of fun and personally enriching to boot. Elizabeth's patriotism united the people. There was a rising tide of English patriotism and pride in the country. Not a bad thing. And she provided them with an enemy. That always helps. Elizabeth did everything she could to distract the Catholic powers that might menace her. To hamstring Spain, she let sail her salty sea dogs. And she supported the Dutch Protestants in a bloody revolt against the Spanish overlords. She encouraged the Protestant Huguenots in a grim civil war in France that crippled any hope of reuniting the old alliance of France and Scotland. Queen Mary, Bloody Mary, had perhaps a better claim to the throne than Elizabeth. But the beautiful, troubled charmer, whose life was a Gothic melodrama, ended up fleeing to rather than marching on England. She reigned in Scotland for only 6 years, during which time she occasionally sparred in interviews with the reformer John Knox. Her doom came when she was charged with being a murderous harlot. She was probably innocent of this once common Scottish practice, but her armies failed to resolve the matter in her favor. Elizabeth imprisoned her cousin Mary for 2 decades, and then reluctantly, we think, ordered her executed as a potential Catholic usurper. As for Elizabeth's other Celtic problem, she sent a huge army to a loyal Catholic and perpetually lawless Ireland under the Earl of Essex. Essex had the impossible task of subduing that land of happy wars and sad love songs. I know people that say the Irish love doing battle, killing and being killed, slaughtering and being slaughtered. And if that does indeed cheer the Irish soul, this was a very happy time. Because when the Earl of Essex went to war against the Irish, there was a lot of killing and dying. So when we talk about Mary and Elizabeth, there's 2 sides of the story. Untying this knot and setting the record straight is a bit of a challenge. We can find things about Elizabeth to admire. She was smart and effective as a ruler. There's no question of that. There's also no question that she was a murderous tyrant who ran a totalitarian state. For those who were not united behind her Anglican church, Elizabeth had a simple remedy. She made Catholicism illegal and branded its adherents as traitors, secretly in league with England's foreign enemies. While the people's patriotism shielded Elizabeth from charges that she was a Bloody Mary in reverse, the great British historian and Protestant Thomas Babington Macaulay wrote that Elizabeth's draconian measures against Catholics were, quote, even more odious than the persecution with which her sister had harassed the Protestants. We say more odious, for Mary had at least the plea of fanaticism. She did nothing for her religion, which she was not prepared to suffer for it. She had held to it firmly under persecution. She fully believed it to be essential to salvation. If she burned the bodies of her subjects, it was in order to rescue their souls. But what can be said in defense of a ruler who is at once indifferent and intolerant? Now for Thomas Macaulay to say that, who by his allegiances you would have thought would praise Elizabeth, for him to say that is significant. Yes, Elizabeth made that combination of indifference and intolerance the very law and spirit of England. While the majority of Englishmen remained at least nominally Catholics, their patriotism compared nearly all of them to submit to the Queen. Perversely, this was especially true after Pope Paul IV excommunicated her, presenting Catholic Englishmen with a choice they did not want to face. It is an irony of history that if the Church had retained its Renaissance spirit and not been thrown on the defensive by the Protestant Reformation, it might have employed subtler diplomacy with the English crown and recovered England for the Church. For the English Reformation was nothing if not worldly, done not on grounds of religion per se, but of maintaining peace and public order. For that score, Elizabeth was in domestic matters as opposed to the Puritans on her left, as she was to the Catholics on her right, despite their soundness on the monstrance regiment of women question. What question is that? Well, she detested, for example, John Knox, whose work, The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women, could not be much enjoyed by a queen. Even as Catholics plotted against her, with encouragement of the papacy, Pope Sixtus V readily confessed that she is certainly a great queen, and were she only a Catholic, she would be our dearly beloved. Just look at how well she governs. She is only a woman, only mistress of half an island, yet she makes herself feared by Spain, by France, by the Empire, by all. The one perhaps irreconcilable point of difference between a Renaissance Pope and Elizabeth might have been authority over the appointment of bishops. But there were certainly precedents in France and elsewhere for an unhappy, if necessary, accommodation by the Church. As it was, the Church, under tremendous pressure and onslaught from the Protestant Reformation, had no more interest in accommodation than Elizabeth did. The Church was embattled and wanted victory. In the end, who can really blame her? Anglicanism asked men to subordinate church doctrine and practice to the discretion of the government. If this was an absurdity, and it was certainly not seen so by Protestants, It was an absurdity tied to patriotism, and an Englishman could grow fond of it over time, even as its inevitable outcome was to secularize society and slowly become atheists as they are today. And slowly England crumbles away, dissolving into indifferentism. At this moment, Britain is decomposing, crumbling away, shambling into dust. Without the binding force of a mighty religion that holds civilizations together and without which they crumble. The English Protestant Reformation proved to be the slow disease of secularism eliding into atheism.
And with atheism weakening the spiritual structure of the society came the end of the English Empire. As local and domestic realpolitik, the policies of Queen Elizabeth made common sense. They seemed to work.
Well, it did make sense, but only in an everyday way, in small things. But there was a large problem. It was a denial of the transcendental truths. It was a denial of the existence of transcendental truths. As such, it was a denial of religious truth. That concept has permeated the modern world. It's the inheritance of British Protestantism and has produced the secularism / atheism that we're experiencing today as our own society dissolves without its spiritual structure. Let's take a short break.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Yes, we're back with you now. We're back with you. This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin on you-supported Real Life Radio and realliferadio.com. Please check on Care to Share on our website. There's great benefits for you there. It's a mutual thing, though. We get benefit, too, when you go there. And if you don't, we love to have you just listening. Let's see. Before the break, we were talking about how Catholicism was forbidden, prescribed by laws. Under Queen Elizabeth, who was a virtual tyrant, a very effective one, though. With Catholicism prescribed by laws as though they were sacrament-bearing Robin Hoods, and with loyalist households creating that English gift to the interior design, the priest hole, where outlaw clerics could be hidden from informers, a remarkable man and cardinal of the church, William Allen, brought hope. He founded a seminary in exile, at Douai, in what was then the Spanish Netherlands, and is now part of France. Here he worked on an English translation of the Latin Vulgate Bible, the Douai-Rheims Bible, which was published shortly before the King James Bible, and trained priests who would be smuggled home to England, God's secret agents. By the end of the 16th century, more than 300 priests were working in England's shadows, dodging the rack and the chopping block, offering the sacraments to believers. But an even greater number of loyal priests and laymen perished under the persecution. Among the most famous was the martyr and later saint Edmund Campion. Dashing, handsome, he'd been a fellow at Oxford, where he had greatly impressed the Queen with his oratory. His studies led him to Rome, or rather first to Douai. He became a Jesuit and returned to England as a priest to Recusance. Of course, recusants are people who wouldn't give up their Catholicism. This was when to be a priest was to be a secret agent, comparable to a celibate and apostolically ordained James Bond, papal monogram on his cufflinks, smuggled into Soviet Russia. Campion was eventually captured and brought to trial. His words spoken before the court that would sentence him to death are unanswerable in their logic. Here they are. The only thing we have to say is this, that if our religion do make us traitors, we are worthy to be condemned, but otherwise are and have been as good subjects as ever the Queen had. In condemning us, you condemn all your own ancestors, all the ancient priests, bishops, and kings, all that was once the glory of England, the island of saints, and the most devoted child of the See of Peter. For what have we taught, however you may qualify it with the odious name of treason, that they did not uniformly teach? Good heavens, for these noble words, Campion was hanged and then butchered. The blood sprayed the coat of Henry Walpole, a young, easygoing, Cambridge-educated wit. That blood and Campion's example made a Jesuit and martyr out of Walpole as well. And so the torturers passed. The English historian C.R.N. Ruth calls Campion that noblest of all the Catholic martyrs, a scholar, a gentleman, a priest, a man of genuine holiness. He was also a lovable, courageous, and honorable Englishman. In the light of his pure religious faith, the natural and necessary political anxieties of his opponents appear almost mean and shabby. But mean and shabby were the natural inheritors of the goggle-eyed whore and the flesh-flapping despot who had severed England from Rome. That refers, of course, to Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII. An accident of lust consummated by state interest, ramified by strategic chess, with barely a theological word, made England the Protestant power par excellence and guarantor of religious division in Europe. The year Elizabeth proclaimed her Act of Uniformity, 1559, the Venetian ambassador to Rome wrote, "In many countries, obedience to the Pope has almost ceased, and matters are becoming so critical that if God does not interfere, they will soon be desperate. Germany leaves little hope of being cured. Poland is in almost hopeless state. The disorders which have lately taken in France and Spain are too well known for me to speak of them, and the Kingdom of England, after returning a short time to her old obedience, has again fallen into heresy. Thus the spiritual power of the Pope is so straitened that the only remedy is a council summoned by the common consent of all princes. Unless this reduces the affairs of religion to order, a grave calamity is to be feared." So wrote the Venetian ambassador. In fact, the Council of Trent had been an occasional session for over 20 years, but to little obvious effect. If the council was of scant use, the papacy was not much better. From Leo X through Julius III, the popes had been more adept at subsidizing art than subduing Protestants. Leo X thought Luther would go away. Pope Hadrian was a reformer more worried about the Turks. Clement VII showed that short of a papal army, they could rival France and the Habsburg. A pope was doomed to the vagaries of power politics, which Clement didn't play very well. After two ineffectual but upright popes, Paul III was a throwback to the Renaissance. He commissioned Michelangelo, awarded cardinal's hats to relatives, and unfortunately, like Clement, feared domination by the Habsburgs more than he feared the breaking up of Christendom. Julius III kept the Renaissance spirit alive by making a handsome 15-year-old monkey keeper a cardinal. But beneath the view of the Venetian ambassador was a groundswell that would reinvigorate the sinews of the Catholic faith. The key man would be Ignatius Loyola. The key army, his creation, the Jesuits. He was born, fittingly, in a castle, 1491, and trained from boyhood to be a knight. Like St. Francis, his dreams were of chivalry and military action. After long service at court, where he led a boisterous and amorous life, he was transferred to the army barracks at Pamplona, and 4 years later he led the defense of the city against the French. He served gallantly, but when his right leg was broken by a cannonball, the game was up, and the city surrendered. His French captor showed the Beaujolais spirit in general in gently bearing the wounded soldier back home to Loyola and his family. His recuperation was long and painful. His leg had to be rebroken and reset, then rebroken and reset again. The young soldier whose reading until now had consisted almost entirely of Amadis of Gaul and other tales of chivalry of the sort later satirized by Cervantes, had only two other book titles at his disposal, A Life of Christ and a collection of the lives of the saints. With nothing better to do, he read. He read these two books, at first reluctantly, and quite bored with them. But soon his imagination seized on the saints and on the Holy Family. He saw them cast in a drama as stirring as knightly battles. In him was reborn the medieval dream of the Crusades. He would rival the saints in holiness and self-denial. He would single-handedly capture Jerusalem. But his ideas of ascetic competition and martial glory faded and were replaced by a vision of peace. Holy Mary and the Christ child appeared to him. Lust left his body, and he was instilled with a commitment to celibacy and a mission repeated throughout his life, to recall women to the example of the Virgin Mother. He eagerly seized the sacrament of penance, taking 3 days to examine his conscience, list his sins, and confess them. He knelt in vigil before a statue of the Virgin and left his weapons at her altar. The former dandified officer gave his fine clothes to the poor, took on the garments of a pilgrim. He intended to march to Barcelona and from there embark for Jerusalem. Along the way, he took shelter in a cave where in prayer and fasting he underwent a dark night, actually dark weeks, a dark night of the soul, mortifying his flesh for his terrible sense of sin to the point that he almost killed himself. He emerged from this bout battered but wiser. The experience of conquering his body became the basis for his famous spiritual exercises. After he had struggled so hard to reach the Holy Land, the Franciscans took one look at this madman crusader, decided he would set interfaith dialogue, as we would call it today, back by 2 centuries, and sent him packing. So he was back in Barcelona. With one medieval avenue cut off to him, he took up another. He became a student, spending more than a decade exercising his mind, as he had exercised his body as a soldier. After 4 years of cramming, he was ready for university studies. He moved restlessly from Alcala to Salamanca and finally to the University of Paris. Got a master's degree. But he was always in trouble. Thrown in prison twice by the Inquisition, beaten senseless by young toughs for preaching chastity to women, mocked and criticized for his disciplined study and severe mortifications. Still in Paris, he developed a following, a small company of men that he led like a military officer in spiritual exercises and hoped to lead to the Holy Land. Among them were 2 future saints. One was St. Francis Xavier. They marched over the Alps to Venice, only to find the city at war with the Turks. There would be no passage to Jerusalem. Making the best of this, they had themselves ordained as priests and retired to Rome, where they offered themselves to Pope Paul III to be deployed as he saw fit. And thus began the great and noble work of the Jesuits, which are the subject of another program. This has been Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin.